For many of us, hearing the numbers of people who died during World War One conceals the very human experience behind them. For every soldier killed, a family waited at home in Ireland to hear news of their loved ones. Liam Geraghty has been finding out what bereavement was like during that time. And here's the story. Liam Geraghty has been finding out what bereavement was like during that time. And here's the story of one woman's extraordinary journey from Wicklow to France to see her dying son.
Of the 210,000 Irishmen who volunteered to fight in the British Army during the First World War, it's estimated that between 27 and 35,000 of them died in the conflict. For families back home, this was a type of bereavement that few had experienced. The bodies of the soldiers were buried where they fell, and then, as Tara Doyle says, a sequence of events took place to inform the family.
Typically, they would get quite a short telegram delivered by telegram boys in small, sort of burnt orange coloured envelopes. And they would have quite a small amount of information on them. They'd just say the person had been killed or wounded. It wouldn't say where because of censorship.
After that, typically the family would receive a letter from an officer who knew the deceased.
And that fleshed out a little bit the details of the death.
And then finally,
anybody who had died was given a bronze memorial piece. They became known as the widow's penny. And, you know, everyone who died, their next of kin got one of those as a memorial of their sacrifice.
While Tara was researching bereavement during World War One, she came across the extraordinary story of Catherine Wynne from Tigroni in Wicklow.
She had two sons serving in the war, Jack and Charlie. And Charlie was her youngest son. They got a telegram telling them that he had been injured by an explosion. He actually had quite a serious injury, shrapnel.
Catherine immediately asked if she could go to visit her son in the casualty clearing station in France. Her request was initially denied.
But once they moved him to a hospital, the War Office said, yes, you could go over.
And so that's what she did.
Obviously, the depth of her love for her son, that nothing was going to stand in her way of going over to see Charlie. Now, you have to remember, she just knew he was injured. She didn't know how serious it was. She didn't have any details about his condition. But she got permission and she got on that boat on her own, 69 years of age, and went to France to see him. The ship that they took from England to France was escorted by destroyers because it was wartime. So, you know, this was serious business.
When she arrived in France, the Red Cross drove her straight to the hospital to see Charlie.
She did read to him. He was able to talk and he knew her and they chatted about home and about the family. There's very poignant notes in the letters where she brings him strawberries because he likes strawberries. But after about a week when she's there, he dies. She wasn't actually there with him. She had seen him the previous night. And she talks about when he's actually gone. And she talks about this bright, sunny, happy boy. And he was only 22. So he was a very young officer. So you can sense this sort of this light being snuffed out in their lives when he's taken from them.
Catherine attended his funeral with her other son, Jack, who was stationed nearby. She wrote a letter to her daughter to inform the family of the loss.
They gave him a sedative, which he longed for, and he lay quite peacefully, quietly, the nurse said, till suddenly he drew two or three long breaths and his dear bright spirit had left us. It's very hard to bear, dearest friend, but even now I can feel thankful that our precious boy has been spared, living on paralysed. We must try to think of him, not of ourselves. We have much to live for, but I feel that the sunshine has gone.
Listening to that story, Edward, of that heartbroken mother, Catherine Wynne, it struck me that it would have been extraordinarily unusual for a mother to be at her son's bedside and attend his funeral in World War One. The reality for most families was that they never got to see their loved one's grave.
Well, that's quite right, Miles. I mean, the First World War was a moment of unprecedented mass killing, which for the people on the home front meant unprecedented mass bereavement. Now, in peacetime, we have all kinds of rituals and coping mechanisms to help us deal with death. So usually in peacetime, older people die. If they die after a period of disease, and this is even the case in the early 20th century, you sort of see it coming. There's a funeral, which, of course, in Ireland are very important things. You know, wakes are used as a way of helping the family get through their bereavement. And then, importantly, you have a grave to visit and a grave to tend. So grief isn't less painful necessarily, but there are ways of dealing with it. All of that stuff, or much of it, is taken away from people in Britain and Ireland and elsewhere during the war. So if your son is killed and buried in France or Belgium during the war, the chances of you visiting his grave are virtually nil. Although some men, like in the story we heard, there, some families, mothers were able to visit their dying sons, not their dead sons, but sons as they were dying. If he was killed in Gallipoli or Salonika or Africa, there was no chance of you visiting him. And the chances, depending on your wherewithal, your financial circumstances, were pretty slim of doing that even after the war.
And what would the impact, Brendan, have been, you know, the psychological impact, if you like, on families, you know, in those instances where they were not able to, in a sense, properly mourn their lost child?
I mean, this leads to very abnormal and disturbed kinds of grieving, which can go on for a lifetime and can echo into future generations as well. And in a sense, they were experiencing, those families were experiencing what, you know, the soldiers themselves experienced, which was sort of the meaninglessness, the randomness of many of these deaths and their lack of control over things that really matter following a death, like funeral rites, ways of commemorating within the family. And these people were also grieving for often a loss of their future. They had not only lost a family member, but they faced a very uncertain future now, financially, emotionally, and in their society. So there was all kind of abnormal grieving going on.